Welcome to What's Left, a weekly political discussion challenging the mainstream left. I'm Eduardo Abarca with co-host, teacher and socialist Andy Lipson and community organizer and socialist Kenny Cepeda. We are online at what-s-left.webno.com. Joining us today is Dr. Eric Lerner to discuss his work on the crisis in cosmology, the Big Bang theory, alternative theories to the Big Bang, and what it all means for us today. Dr. Lerner is president and chief scientist at LPP Fusion, a small clean energy R&D company. He is the author of The Big Bang Never Happened, and for 30 years has been one of the leading cosmology researchers who are critical of the Big Bang hypothesis. His papers have been published in major peer-reviewed journals such as Astrophysical Journal and the Monthly Notices of the Royal Astronomical Society. He is also an active researcher in the effort to develop fusion energy, the power of the sun and stars, for use here on Earth. He has been a socialist activist for decades and is currently a member of the Jobs and Equal Rights for All campaign and the International Luxembourgist Network. Dr. Lerner, thank you for being here.
Okay, and it's Mr. Lerner. You can call me Eric. We don't stand on formalities here.
All right, then. Yes. Well, thank you for being with us, Eric. Andy,
thanks, Eric.
Yes. Andy, you actually had made this connection. You came up with the idea of inviting our guest today. Can you just briefly tell us why it was so important to you to have Eric on our show today?
Yeah. Well, I'm a physics teacher. I teach physics in high school, and we're sheltering in place, and so when I'm bored, I look into things that are, I have questions during the course of the year, like, and the stuff, increasingly I've been having questions about dark energy and dark matter, and just recognizing or starting to believe that particle accelerator CERN not really finding anything, I was just like, what's going on in physics? What's going on in science? It just doesn't make sense. And I saw a YouTube video of Eric's where it talks about the crisis in cosmology, and when I watched it and it started really raising big questions, not just about the crisis in cosmology, but things that I took as face value, like the Big Bang. It really just sort of opened up bigger questions to me, like that we've been talking about this episode about science being a place of truth that you can kind of trust them, and it's just like, I was just really struck by by the way he presented the material, like in a very matter-of-fact way. But it kind of really shook me as like, wow, there are real big questions we should be having about these things. And I'm wondering, why does the science community not tell us that there are alternatives to these things when, you know, they should? So I reached out to him and was like, hey, would you be willing to like do an interview here? Not really thinking that he'd get back to me, but he did, and you did, and I really appreciate that. So I was like, I'm definitely gonna take advantage of getting to hear more about this and more about science, more about alternative ideas, and then when he expressed interest in talking about what it means for us in terms of the world today, I was just very excited about having you know, you here, Eric.
Thank you.
Thanks for the invitation.
Dr. Lerner, if you could just, give us a brief background of who you are and just tell us a little bit about yourself, if we can start off that way.
Okay, well, I've been involved in physics for a long time. I graduated from Columbia University back in 1968, which was an interesting year to graduate from Columbia because, of course, that was the year of the Columbia student strike, which I participated in. So I initially didn't think that I was going to get involved in the fields of physics that I eventually ended up in. I was actually initially going into particle physics, what's today called high energy physics. But in the course of my first year in graduate school, I became skeptical of whether this was going in the right direction at all. I didn't know what the correct direction was, but it didn't seem to me like something that I really wanted to get involved in. And I actually terminated my graduate education, went into science writing. So I, for a long time, I made a living as a science journalist, but I pretty rapidly got back involved in fusion energy and in the study of astrophysics. And to make a long story short, what basically was clear was that these problems, the problems of how to get a new energy source for humanity, fusion energy, and the problems of astrophysics, of the history of the universe, those problems were tightly related, and they both related to what's called plasma physics, the study of plasmas. Now, plasma is a gas in which electrons can freely move and can conduct electricity. So here on Earth, the simplest example of plasma is, for example, inside a plasma television screen. In nature, a lightning bolt is plasma, the aurora are plasma. But in the universe, plasma is most of the universe. The sun and all the other stars are made of plasma. Everything in between is plasma. So the study of this is crucial to understanding the universe, and it's also crucial to this question of fusion energy. At the same time, and throughout my whole life, I've been an activist. I was first involved in the civil rights movement. I actually marched in the Selma March. And then I was involved in the student movement, Columbia student strike, and the later movements, socialist movements that came out of that. And I rapidly came to the conclusion moving ahead in society, making a transition from our present society to a socialist society, necessitated the change in how we get our energy from fossil fuels to fusion. Long time ago, Karl Marx wrote something to the effect of, you know, if you're given a water mill, you get a feudal lord. Given a steam mill, you get a capitalist. Well, the equivalent is, given fusion energy, then you get a socialist society. Or you could put it in reverse. Without fusion, you can't evolve beyond capitalism. So that was basically how I got started. Now, in the course of my work, I discovered pretty rapidly that in order to pursue the fusion work, which required significant funding, I would have to get this funding on my own. And initially, I did get some preliminary funding from NASA, from their Jet Propulsion Lab. And during this time, I was also doing on my own the research in cosmology and astrophysics. But in 2001, this very modest funding we were getting from JPL was terminated, and in fact, NASA terminated all of their fusion research at the same time. So at that point, pretty short process over a couple of years, I figured out that the only way I was going to get funding for fusion was to have a company in which I could get investors. So I, by necessity, became a socialist capitalist. So we had to set up a small R&D company, and we struggled for quite some time. The first 5 years, we had insignificant funding. But finally, we were able to get some funding in 2008, right at the time of the financial crisis. And on that basis, we started a research project in New Jersey. And I'm going to be talking about that a little bit more later. So all during that time, I was doing research in cosmology and publishing papers. Cosmology has the advantage that the U.S. government and other governments do pay for these giant satellites and giant telescopes that produce all the data. And since it is government-funded, the data is available to everybody. So you can do data analysis of astrophysics and cosmology without having a huge amount of funding. So during all that time, I was working on that. So that pretty much brings us up to the present, in which time there is much greater interest in both of these fields, the public interest both in fusion and in what people are terming the crisis in cosmology, is ramping up a lot. So this is a good time to be discussing these things.
Yeah, yeah. And I was wondering if you could start us off with that, as you understand it, the crisis in cosmology. The things that I read were about the Hubble constant and two different ways of measuring the Hubble constant that aren't coming together. I think that's the way things I've read more commonly, because you refer to it in your talk about how it's being talked about more right now. Is that how you understand the crisis in cosmology, about this essentially problem over two different Hubble constants that aren't coming together, and that seem to indicate that there's a deeper problem in the theories about the origins of the universe as a result of that? Or maybe you can talk about that more.
There's a difference between what's publicized in as the crisis in cosmology and what I call the real crisis in cosmology. And that can be summed up very easily. What's publicized is a single problem. What's not publicized is that the basic consensus theory, which is the Big Bang hypothesis, is all problem and no result. It's Swiss cheese with all holes and no cheese. And that's what's not being publicized. And these problems can only be resolved and can be resolved if you move away from, you basically abandon the basic hypothesis that the universe began with a hot, dense explosion, what people refer to as the Big Bang. So let me go into this a little bit, because this is a long story, but I think that each point you should interrupt me with questions. So the way I look at it is, you can sort of say there are six major predictions that the Big Bang makes about the universe, the Big Bang theory makes about the universe. And each of these is fundamentally contradicted by observations. So the big thing in science is, science gives us the ability to predict what will happen. And that's the key usefulness of science to humanity. Now, you can make these predictions about experiments you can do, or you can make these predictions about observations that you're going to perform in the future. For example, on objects that are far too big to experiment with, like stars and galaxies. Consistently, the Big Bang Theory has made predictions that are wrong. So let me try and just go through some of these, and we'll get to the one that people are publicizing, but we'll get to that last. So the first prediction, the most basic fundamental predictions of the Big Bang come from what has to happen if you have matter at high temperature and high density. What we know has to happen is that fusion reactions have to occur with the nuclei. So a fusion reaction is when nuclei of atoms come together at high temperature and they fuse together to make other elements. So in the Big Bang, there is a prediction that three elements, three nuclei are produced. The one that's produced in most abundance is ordinary helium. Second of all, there's lithium, what we use in lithium batteries. And third of all is deuterium, which is simply the heavier form of hydrogen. It's hydrogen that has one proton and one neutron in the nucleus. So these are very precise predictions, but they can be tested by observations. And over decades, the observations have diverged more and more from the predictions. So to take an example, let's look at lithium. So lithium is not a common element in the universe. Lithium is less than parts per billion compared with hydrogen. But we can look at the spectra of stars. So we spread out their light with a prism or a grating. And from the bright lines, we can deduce, people have been doing this for centuries, what elements are in the star and at what abundance. So people look at what they call old stars. And old stars in the galaxy are those that have very little abundance of elements other than hydrogen. So these elements are produced by stars other than these first three that are assumed to be produced by the Big Bang. And if we see very few of those, so especially very little iron, then we say these are the oldest stars. So if you look at this graph plots for the oldest stars, the abundance of lithium in parts per billion compared with hydrogen, which is the most abundant element, versus the abundance of iron, also in parts per billion. Now, these red lines up here are the very firm predictions of the Big Bang Theory. This is how much lithium has to be produced if the Big Bang is valid. And these dots down here are the actual observations. And as you get to purer and purer stars, which are the older and older stars, you see that these actual observations, the lithium dwindles away to essentially almost zero, consistent with the oldest stars having no lithium at all. So there's an enormous gap, basically a factor of 20, between the predictions and the observations, a gap which has been getting worse as the observations get better. Now, cosmologists are fond of, over the last decade, of calling this the epoch of precision cosmology, that they're getting their predictions to precise to 1%. And my reply to that is, well, what we're getting is to the era in which cosmology is precisely wrong. So if we look at helium, now helium is at the other end of the spectrum because helium is the second most abundant element in the universe. About 25% of the mass of the universe is in the form of helium, the great bulk of the other 75% being hydrogen. So there's a very precise 24.5% prediction for the abundance of helium. But again, if we do the same thing, we look at stars and we see how does the abundance of helium track against the abundance of other elements, which confusingly is, they use the letter Z. And we find that the abundance goes way down to 10 or 11%, way below the predictions of the Big Bang.
Can I stop you on one thing there?
For two out of the three elements, these predictions are completely wrong. Now, deuterium, actually, they do get approximately right, but in most classes, if you get a 33% grade on a test, you flunk, and that's true in science, too. Your predictions have to be right. They can't be one-third right. So this is the first area where there's a clear contradiction between predictions and observations. So is that fairly clear?
Yeah, just I have one question about this second graph. Is that there's a red line that goes across and then a blue line that goes down. What maybe I'm trying to understand what you would predict, which one of those is the one you would predict?
Okay, well, I'm sorry. The prediction is, again, would be a horizontal line right about at 20.245.
Right. Yeah.
So the red line and the blue line are purely, they're just, as it were, fits. They're just to guide the eye to show that this slope changes as you get to the purer and purer, the older and older stars.
But that would the predicted line wouldn't even be at an angle. It would be straight across, correct?
That's right.
Okay.
So that's, as we could say, problem number one. Well, problem number two is also very basic. If you have a Big Bang universe, the Big Bang hypothesis says that the universe is 12 or 13 billion years old. Now, part of this crisis in cosmology, the publicized crisis, is that there are two predictions which conflict with each other by a billion years. But if you compare, again, these predictions with observation, you get a much bigger discrepancy because obviously the universe has to be older than any object inside the universe. But when we look at the age of objects inside the universe, we get ages that are much greater than 12 or 13 billion years. So one way of looking at objects is to say, how long would it have taken to form these objects? Well, you can determine that if you know how fast matter is moving in these objects and how big they are. And roughly speaking, how old they are can be obtained by simply dividing how big they are with how fast the matter in them is moving. Now, there are a few small numerical factors you have to throw in, but basically that's the idea. Obviously, if you have a convention on Earth and you say, well, people have to get to this convention by walking, so you know that people are walking at about 4 miles an hour, and you say, well, the people are coming to this convention from the nearest 5 mile radius. Well, you can tell that that convention is going to take at least an hour to come together. Mm-hmm. So this is the same thing that we can do on a much larger scale. What we find is we can measure the velocity that things are moving in the universe. And that turns out to be always slower than about 1,000 kilometers a second. 1,000 kilometers a second seems pretty speedy by earthly standards, but it's 300 times slower than the speed of light. So if we look at the largest objects, we can see what's the oldest objects. So when we look out into space, the more we look out into space, the further we look out into space, the larger the objects we see. So now people are seeing conglomerations of galaxies that are more than a gigaparsec across. Well, a gigaparsec is 3 billion light years.
Oh, wow.
So it takes like 3 billion years to get from one side of the objects to the other. Well, if the matter in these objects is moving at only 1/300th the speed of light, it means that it must have taken hundreds of billions or even trillions of years for these objects to form. That's not even close to the predicted life of the universe, according to the Big Bang theory. So these objects are much older. So in this diagram, for example, this shows the relative density of galaxies as we move out into space away from the Earth, looking deeper into deeper space with our telescopes. And these big hills and valleys shows that there are objects, there are concentrations that are billions of light years across. And these narrow curved lines, that shows what we would expect if they were just random fluctuations. So these are much bigger than random fluctuations. If we look with other objects than galaxies, very bright objects called gamma ray bursters, we can look at the sky and we can see that these gamma ray bursters are concentrated in huge conglomerations on the sky. And when people calculate how big they are, they come out to approximately the same level, so that they're about 1 or 2 or 3 billion light years across. So this is very strong evidence that you can't have a universe as young as 12 or 13 billion years when you have objects in it that are hundreds of billions or trillions of years old. Again, this goes across the spectrum. People have found stars that are much older than the age of the universe, galaxies that are much older than the age of the universe. There are ways of estimating the age of stars and galaxies that people agree on. Again, this is given a name. It's called the age problem, oddly enough. And people have known about this problem for decades, and it's been getting worse and worse. Well, just like the helium problem and the lithium problem, the attitude of Big Bang theorists is, well, these are just individual anomalies. They're very interesting. We can think about them. We know that we don't know the answer to them. But they don't contradict the underlying theory because, hey, the theory works in all these other areas.
Can I ask a question?
Go ahead.
We're looking at the graph here that says LSS greater than 1 that has these two lines that kind of spread out, correct?
Right.
Would the Big Bang Theory predict that that everything should stay within those two sets of lines? Is that?
That's right, because okay. Those two sets of lines are just based on the statistics that, well, our telescope is looking at a given part of a limited part of the universe. And it's, of course, there's going to be random variation. If you were looking at a truly homogeneous group of galaxies in which there were no concentrations on this scale, of course, there'd be a few more here and a few fewer there just by chance. Well, that chance distribution is defined by those gently sloping lines. So what this graph shows is that the actual variation is an order of magnitude greater. So the probability that we'd see this distribution in a truly homogeneous distribution of galaxies is just infinitesimal. This can't be a chance effect.
Yeah. And you mentioned that Big Bang scientists, the ones who still use that, are obviously it's most scientists, because that's all I've ever heard about. They say that there is some data that really holds together, or there are some observations that really hold together. Is it worth it to say what are they saying? What are the observations that they're willing to say hold together,
well,
that they're willing to dismiss?
That's the point I was getting to, is that each time one of these objections is raised, they will say, well, the rest of the theory is great, so this must be an anomaly. But when you go through the list of objections, you don't have anything left. There's nothing left where there isn't a problem, there isn't a fundamental contradiction. So I'll go through each point and you'll see that there really isn't anything left. So one of the things that I'm working on is a scientific paper that goes through all of these points together. Which hasn't been done for some time. So the next fundamental contradiction is in the expansion of the universe itself. What has been observed since the time of Hubble in the 1920s is that there is a correlation between the redshift and the apparent magnitude of galaxies. So what do these terms mean? The apparent magnitude of a galaxy is very simple. It means how bright it is. And you can take other objects like supernova, where people have good reason to believe that their brightness is pretty consistent. And you can say the dimmer they are, the more distant they are. So that's a measure of distance. It's just how bright they are. The redshift refers back to these spectra. So as I said, there are certain lines at certain colors, certain frequencies that correspond to specific elements. And Edwin Hubble discovered in the 1920s that these lines were at the wrong place. They were shifted slightly to the red part of the spectrum, to longer wavelengths. And that shift became more pronounced as you went to dimmer and therefore more distant galaxies. So that correlation between two observables, the redshift and the apparent magnitude, that's called a Hubble relationship. Now, the Big Bang hypothesis is that this relationship is because the universe is expanding. Space itself is expanding, and therefore the redshift is caused by that stretching of space, by objects moving further away. Everything stretches, including the light that's emitted. So it stretches to longer wavelengths, and that's why we see the redshift. Well, that's just a hypothesis. It's different than saying it's the only explanation for the Hubble relationship. Well, that hypothesis is a very strong and very striking prediction, and that's that the surface brightness of objects will decline greatly with distance. What we mean by surface brightness is the apparent brightness of an object, how bright it looks, divided by its apparent size on the sky. Now, in ordinary space, in the space that I'm sitting in right now, if you take a lamp and you move it twice as far away, that lamp will look four times as dim. But its apparent diameter is going to be half as big. The area is going to be a quarter as big. And if you divide those two numbers, you get unity. So in ordinary space, the surface brightness of an object is independent of its distance. It's constant. If the space is expanding, then you have another situation. If you imagine this object is so far away from us that by the time light has gotten to us, the space has expanded significantly and the object has moved further away, you get an optical illusion. The object appears to be closer and therefore bigger than it really is. So the light is more spread out and therefore the surface brightness is dimmer. Also, the expansion of the universe, this hypothetical expansion, actually stretches out the light that's emitted. So there are fewer photons, fewer particles of light arriving. So if you put all these things together, you get that the surface brightness declines as the cube of 1 plus the redshift. So that means if you're at a redshift of 6, which is observable by our big telescopes, the surface brightness is down by 6 cubed, which is a factor of 200. So this is a big, big effect. And this is what people expected to see when the Hubble telescope started functioning back in the 1990s. Well, by God, that's not at all what they saw. What they saw was, yeah, the galaxies got dimmer, the galaxies got smaller, and the surface brightness remained exactly the same. So again, people said, well, this is an anomaly. We can't understand it. My colleagues, Ricardo Scarpa and Renato Flamo, and I worked on this, and we found that to an extreme degree of precision, here's precision cosmology for you, the radii, the apparent radii of these galaxies was to within 1%, and the surface brightness was constant to within 1% of what you would expect in a non-expanding universe. So an expanding universe is completely excluded by this. And I won't get into the complexities, but their answer to this was, well, the galaxies were really, really tiny galaxies when they started. They were babies, and they grew up to be big galaxies. And this change in diameter just exactly compensated this surface brightness dimming. So just by coincidence, we got this perfectly flat line. Well, we published further papers that showed that this was physically impossible, that you got physical absurdities if you assumed this galaxy growth. So this is, again, a fundamental contradiction. Now, if you ask, well, if it's not expansion of the universe, what does cause the redshift distance relationship? I have to respond, well, right now we don't know. That is one phenomena that we would need some change in laws of physics to explain how light loses energy, and that means shifts to the red, as it travels. But that's something that can be tested. There are satellites that we can launch that could go into the solar system and be so sensitive that we could measure changes in light frequency traveling from one spacecraft to another. And this is something that cosmologists say the solar system is definitely not expanding. So this does require a modification of our understanding of electromagnetism, but it is an alternative to the expansion of the universe, which is excluded by the surface brightness data. So let me stop there for questions.
You mentioned it, Eric, that these three supposedly, these three are the like anomalies for the scientific community. Yet it seems like it's enough proof to disprove the Big Bang. Why is it that scientists are holding on to the Big Bang theory so tightly? Then it just seems to me that they just, this is enough for them to delve into, for them to reconsider the entire theory.
The answer is really sociological, not scientific.
Right.
I mean, there's two big problems in cosmology. One is cosmology has become isolated from technology. In the past, the study of the universe has been linked to useful technologies. If you go back to the time of Newton, for example, when Newton started to develop a precise theory of gravitation, which allowed people to predict where objects in the sky would be, such as where the moon would be in its orbit, which was impossible to predict with the geocentric theories of Ptolemy. People realized that if you could predict where an object was in the sky at a certain time, and you could measure that, you knew what time it was. Well, why does it matter what exact time it is? Well, if you know what time it is, and you can measure where the sun is, you know your longitude. You know where you are on Earth. Well, in Newton's time, when people were sailing across the Atlantic, that became a matter, literally, of life and death. And it certainly became a matter of great commercial interest, is whether you could navigate precisely enough. And it took a century to turn the fundamental scientific discoveries of Newton and Leibniz and others into a precise set of astronomical tables that sailors could bring with them, and they could navigate with these. In the 20th century, one of the big problems of astrophysics was to understand the source of energy of the sun. And in 1930, Hans Bethe, based on discoveries that were being made in the lab about nuclear energy, was able to hypothesize that the source of the sun's energy was nuclear fusion, was the conversion of hydrogen nuclei into helium nuclei. It's been 90 years since then. We have not yet been able to convert that into a useful technology, but that was the start, was from astrophysics. Well, right now, that link has been broken. Cosmology is viewed as a totally separate, pure science that has no implications for technology. And that means that hypotheses can float off into the heavens because they can't be tested here on Earth in terms of technological development. The ultimate proof of scientific validity is our ability to create technology. People say, well, you know, isn't science just like a religious belief, just what scientists believe? And I've heard even scientists say this. And I was having this discussion with a cosmologist in an airport. And I said, well, Alan, if you really believe that, I would not recommend you get on that airplane. Because what holds that airplane up is our understanding, scientists' understanding over decades of it, the science of aerodynamics. That's why it stays in the air. So when that link is broken, then you don't have a real check on science. Second of all, if you look at how cosmology is funded, in an extremely centralized way. Funding for cosmology in the United States, for example, goes through just two committees. One is at National Science Foundation, and the other is at NASA. Well, these committees are stacked with people with theoreticians who have spent their entire lives developing the Big Bang theory. And if you come up with a funding proposal, we're going to examine how the Big Bang theory is wrong. Not only won't they fund you, and I have heard these anecdotes, so I'm quite sure that they're true. I've heard them first person. But in many cases, they'll say, you know, if you fund this, we're not going to fund anything in your department forever. I've had talked to tenured professors who are even heads of department, who are afraid to come to a conference. This is changing now. But 10 years ago, people were afraid to come to conferences about problems in the Big Bang Theory because they thought it would hurt their career and the career of their grad students. So that's a key sociological problem. The third key sociological problem is that cosmology is dominated numerically by theoreticians. Most fields of science, the experimentalists, the people who produce the observations, vastly outnumber the theoreticians. So the theoreticians are using experiments by many experimentalists to get hypotheses. So that means, you know, numbers count. The theoreticians have to pay attention to what the experimentalists are doing. In cosmology, it's the opposite. Most cosmologists are theoreticians. The experimentalists who deal with the data that comes from the satellites are a small minority, and they basically are dominated by these theoreticians. The people who are actually putting the satellites up, they're not cosmologists at all. They're technologists in completely different fields. So the final point I'll just leave to later. There also is a strong resonance between the Big Bang theory and certain tendencies in society. The most obvious resonance is the Big Bang theory is consistent with the ideology of many huge religions in the world, which do hypothesize creation myths. And the Big Bang is, to a large extent, a creation myth that fits in with that. If you look at the origin of the Big Bang theory, with Abbé Lemaître, who was a Jesuit priest in the 1920s, part of his explicit written motivation was to try and develop a scientific narrative that reinforced what he saw as the Christian idea of creatio ex nihilo, creation from nothingness. So all of these sociological problems have interfered with what would have been a normal development in which the Big Bang theory was rejected after it flunked so many tests. But I'm not through with all those tests it's flunked. If I could have a little bit more time.
Well, we're at 55 minutes, and okay. I know, because I know there's also the notion of the prediction of a homogeneous universe versus the findings of a non-homogeneous universe, right, that are finding things like that. I do wonder, for me at least, so things like dark energy, dark matter, those are kind of theoretical inventions, it seems then, to try to hold this thing together, so that it's led us to actually saying that all those things that are on the periodic table represent only like 5% of the universe, and 95% of the universe is something that we can't see by definition as dark matter, and that something that they're calling like anti-gravity, dark energy that pushes things apart. But we haven't proven, there's literally no evidence of those things existing. Is that partly, so it's holding on to the Big Bang theory has produced these two things? That's the first question. And secondly, I guess, the Large Hadron Collider, when I was looking into it, one of the justifications is it's supposed to sort of reproduce the conditions of the Big Bang. Is the Large Hadron Collider also then a kind of, in your mind, a sort of a byproduct of this Big Bang notion?
Well, let me talk about the dark matter and dark energy. So the problems with the Big Bang are very long-standing. They go back decades. And every time there's been a problem, the Big Bang theory has become more complicated. And what are called ad hoc hypotheses have been introduced. The first one, back in the 1970s, was dark matter. Matter that is not like the matter we see here on Earth. Matter that we should have been able to observe in very expensive experiments that have done over the last 30 years, but has never been observed.
Right.
And that was introduced because there was a contradiction between the prediction of how much matter there should be in the universe and how much matter was needed to make these Big Bang nucleosynthesis, these Big Bang fusion predictions come out right. They couldn't both be right, and therefore there must be matter that didn't participate in the fusion reactions. Then people discovered, and this was a theoretical discovery, that the Big Bang theory did not really predict an isotropic cosmic microwave background. So the cosmic microwave background, which is this very even bath of low energy radiation coming from all parts of the sky, that was used as proof that the Big Bang happened. That's a big stretch, but that's what happened in the 1960s. But then people realized that it was inconsistent, that as the universe expanded, there would have been pieces that were never in equilibrium with each other because they were so distant. And we would see these pieces as very different radio intensities. We'd see a patchwork sky instead of the smooth sky. So the second fudge factor, as I call it, was inflation. There was this new field, never observed on Earth, never could be observed on Earth, called the inflationary field, which made the Big Bang go much faster than they had previously predicted. And that smoothed everything out into this even bath that they already knew existed. I mean, inflation was the wildest one. That was a real leap into the unknown. And yet it was accepted because it resolved these earlier theoretical problems. Then, you know, you had in the late 90s that even with these two fudge factors, you had many contradictions, for example, with the observations of supernova were supposed to be at a certain brightness, and they were at a different brightness. So third fudge factor, dark energy, which again, there's really no difference between inflation and dark energy and fairy dust. These are impossible quantities that we have no evidence for in the lab, and in those cases, we can have no evidence for them. Dark energy and inflation exists on scales and on times that can never be reproduced in the laboratory. So this isn't science. You can't make predictions that can't be contradicted in laboratory experiments. But cosmology is in such a fix that these predictions are not even self-consistent. That's what the crisis of cosmology has been, is that on the one hand, you can measure the Hubble relationship and the Hubble constant, which is the constant relationship between distance and redshift, with supernova and by other means. And second, you can use this Rube Goldberg theory to predict what it should be based on measurements of the cosmic microwave background. And those two predictions, which are supposedly both precise to 0.1%, are not the same. So now this is a crisis that they couldn't sweep under the rug like all the others, because it pitted two groups of scientists against another. Both were saying, well, our prediction is right, and since the theory can't be questioned, your observations have to be wrong. And the other side has been saying, well, you know, our observations are right. Now, at the moment, their situation is they're throwing up their hands, but it's obvious to anybody outside of this closed priesthood that the underlying theory is wrong. You get rid of these contradictions if you say the Big Bang never happened. There is a different explanation for the Hubble relationship, and there's a different explanation for the cosmic microwave background. It turns out that there's a lot of evidence for another explanation. As I like to say, if you're on a camping trip, you climb out of your tent and you look around and all you see is white, you do not conclude you're looking at an explosion that began the universe. You say to yourself, oh, the fog rolled in. Well, what we're looking at is a radio fog. There is a lot of evidence that radio waves, as they travel very long distances, are scattered and randomized as they move through the universe. And that the amount of energy that it takes to produce the helium we observe, which was produced in stars, is equal to the amount of energy that the microwave background contains. Now, we're going to get into some alternatives, so I'll leave it at that. But the key thing is getting rid of the crisis means getting rid of the Big Bang hypothesis and starting to look at what the universe looks like if you don't have this, if you don't have this Procrustean bed to fit it into.
Eric, it almost seems to me that when I hear you talk about these things, I almost hear that we're talking about economics as well. And, you know, these set of fundamental ideas that are pushed into society. And if you question those ideas, you're pushed to the fringes of, you know, funding and being able to expose your ideas. I'm just curious, I don't know if this is the moment, but if you can maybe talk about those struggles of, you know, being isolated from the mainstream of, you know, your field of, you know, physics. And I mean, you mentioned that you had to create your own research company in order to do this work. But I don't know if you can expand on that and how, what are the struggles you face and how do you propose changing that dominant mindset?
Well, that's a big ball of questions. Yeah. Let me get into, before I get into some alternatives, let me get into why does this really matter? I mean, I think that cosmology and the crisis in cosmology matters in two big ways. One is cosmology and astrophysics really are still connected to technology. What I and many other, dozens of other researchers have shown over the last decades, including Hannes Alfvén, who won the Nobel Prize for Physics in 1970, is that what we learn about these plasmas in the universe can be applied to creating fusion here on Earth. By broadening that discussion, we can make progress on getting an energy source that is far cheaper than present fossil fuels. So stopping the diversion of trillions of dollars from us into the pockets of the billionaires. Far cleaner, get rid of all of the pollution, CO2, the pollution that's killing people, the particle pollution. All of this can be done with knowledge that we can actually derive from the study of the universe and test in the laboratory. So there's a mutual relationship. So that's one thing where this makes a difference. The other big difference is ideological. And, you know, people sometimes laugh. There was one comment on one of our videos, oh, I based my whole life on the Big Bang and now it's false. And people were sort of laughing, what does this matter? But ideologically, it does matter. If you look at how science is covered, even though cosmology and astrophysics are a tiny part of physics, which is a relatively small part of the whole of science, most scientists are in the biological sciences. The press covers cosmology at a very high level, as if this is the most important part of science. And that creates a huge problem, because the Big Bang Theory is nonsense. And people can see it's nonsense. You know, dark matter, dark energy, inflation, multiple dimensions, multi-universes, it gets worse and worse. As Alfheim wrote 30 years ago, this confuses in the popular mind science and science fiction. So it really discredits science as a tool to make sense of the universe. On the one hand, it basically says, well, you know, if the whole scientific description of the origin and history of the universe doesn't make any sense, why should we expect anything else science says to make any sense? So it's a real discrediting of science. And second of all, it creates, to the extent that you take it seriously, it creates a version of the history of the universe that doesn't give any guidance to how evolution happens here on Earth. It seems like an absolute contradiction, because the Big Bang universe is a universe that's running downhill. It basically started with this big, exciting explosion, and everything goes downhill until it evaporates into either the Big Rip or everything expands into nothingness. And people have commented on that. It's basically a meaningless universe. The contrary idea of a universe without an origin in time, a universe which has been running up, which has been evolving at a faster and faster pace, with greater and greater energy density, actually gives guidance to how crises in evolution, both in the universal frame and here on Earth and here in society, can be overcome. So it basically makes a big difference on how the myth of origins or an actual scientific view of the evolution of the universe can affect how we view social evolution. So those are two ways it makes sense, it makes a difference.
Here's one thing I'm wondering, because to get into the alternative and to get into the ideas of the plasmoid stuff that I read about in terms of fusion, part of me wonders if we should break this up into two parts so we could actually connect alternative theories of how the universe and spend a little bit more time on that and then get a little deeper into the notion, the fusion stuff you showed me that I saw the video on, because I think there's some neat stuff there.
Yeah, I think that it would be good to devote a whole hour to the alternatives, the connection to fusion, and the connection to the present social crisis.
Yeah, yeah.
We can get into all that next time.
Eduardo, do you have any more questions? I probably have one last question.
Why don't you go ahead with your question?
Well, this is one that Kenny and I were both thinking about, and I guess it's a more personal question. Because I feel this sometimes, and I think Kenny feels this sometimes, as people who are to the left of many of our revolutionary comrades, do you feel like, can you talk about isolation and that sense of despair, or how do you deal with the fact that you look at these things and it's like, this is crazy, this is wrong, you have alternatives, and in some ways, you're just not getting this, I listen to. Do you experience that, and can you talk about
that?
Well,
I mean, I would say fortunately, I have been part of communities in both cosmology and infusion. Now, these communities only overlapped in a few people. The most notable about is the person who I most consider my mentor in these subjects, which is, I was fortunate to briefly be associated with Dr. Althing. But there's always been, during my lifetime, a group of people, and Althing was the most prominent, who were critical of the Big Bang. And they're quite a diverse group in terms of their own views, but there was a group of people that we could talk to. And although it took patience and there was frustration, I was able to get my research published. My biggest coup in the early days was getting one paper published in Astrophysical Journal, which the editor said, not too jokingly, that his agreement to publish it was going to get him into a lot of hot water. So in that way, I've never been totally isolated. And the same goes in the fusion work. There's always been a group of many people working on the dense plasma focus device, which I've been working on for decades. Obviously, in the case of fusion, the extreme frustration is fusion is an experimental work. To do experiments, you do need some money. You can't do it on your own the way you can do theoretical cosmology. And it was a tremendous struggle to get that funding. And as I say, eventually, the only way was to create a private company. So that struggle has never ended. It's ongoing. So in the sense of being totally socially isolated, fortunately, that hasn't really happened. But in the sense of being isolated from funding sources, of course, that's a huge problem. And I think that for anyone working in this field, that is the critical problem. And most people just don't have the time in cosmology to devote unfunded research. They've got classes to teach, they've got funded research to do, and therefore, it's enormously held back the field.
Well, I think that would be where we start wrapping up, because it is, otherwise we'd delve into the part two of it,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, because for part two, I'm interested in exploring, you know, those, the connections to capitalism and, you know, like, for example, like fighting against, like, maybe the fossil fuel industry or competing energy sources. And so maybe that's probably part two, I think.
As I say, that gets the connection to cosmology very much gets into the alternative way of dealing with the universe and its evolution if you don't have a Big Bang, and bringing cosmology back into relationship with technology and evolution, which is something people have been, I mean, again, this is not my work alone. It's something people have been working on for really the last 80 or 90 years. So in the next episode, talking about that, alternatives will be a way of bringing it much closer to the present day.
Perfect. Dr. Leonard, what you are implying here is very, or what you are, what you have, what your life's work has been, it's just, is very threatening to a lot of the long-standing theories of cosmology. And even last night when I was studying for this episode on cosmology, it just, even the notions of the expanding of the universe or dark matter or just the age of matter that exists in the universe. It's very embedded in not just, you know, just in the scientific community, but in the educational field as well, where much of us, because I'm in the educational field, having been a former educator, even in elementary school, the Big Bang Theory is widely the standard for what you
right.
teach children of how the universe started. This is going against the grain. I mean, this is what you're talking about.
Right, and as I say, that gets into the sociology of why scientists, and I've talked to these scientists, I mean, this is not theoretical, why scientists are very reluctant to challenge the Big Bang directly. They will publish a paper that you look at the conclusions and you say, hey, this is totally inconsistent with the Big Bang. But you look at the paper and the conclusion doesn't say that. They don't connect the dots because they know that's going to be really bad for their career. They're going to be labeled some sort of heretic. So, yeah, I mean, the fact that this is seeped into the general culture, but I think it has had a very pernicious effect because it implies to a child growing up, to an adult who's interested, this stuff doesn't make sense to you because, you know, you can't think in 10 dimensions. You're not, you know, you're not up to the level of the priesthood. And, you know, I think that turns off a lot of people to science, particularly to physics. I mean, there's a lot to physics that has nothing to do with cosmology. Most physicists are not cosmologists. But since this is the most publicized part of physics, people identify with it and they say, well, man, I can never understand this. This is totally beyond me. And one of the things that I think is very positive about the alternative is the alternative does make sense, and the alternative can be understood by people who, like most of us, can't think in 10 dimensions.
Thank you. This is just incredible. I think this is a good place for us to sort of wrap up for this part one.
Okay.
With our conversation with Dr. Eric Lerner, and we'll have to invite you again.
Just remember, I'm Mr. Lerner. I dropped out of the PhD program. But I think that this is again an indication. This is part of the ideology, is that the physicists, you know, the PhDs, the doctors, they're this priesthood that understand things. They speak in a language you can't understand, right? The priests of Catholic Europe conversed in Latin, and they conversed in Latin long after Latin was the language of their countries. Precisely because nobody else could understand them. It gave them a lot of power. While, you know, mathematics is a language, and it's not a language that most people are comfortable in. So you have this priesthood of the doctors, the PhDs, that, you know, pretend to know things that no one else can understand. So anyway, just watch it. I'm Mister.
All right.
I know that wasn't intended to get at, but I think what you said about the doctor, mister, and the priesthood, I just feel like it's a really important point.
Yeah. Well, listen, I'll tell you one other thing which can go in or not go in was when I was starting to try and get funding for fusion, I was working with another scientist, Tony Perrat, who was a former student of Hannes Alfvén. And I started getting concerned when I couldn't get the funding that partly maybe the problem was I didn't have the PhD. I had dropped out, even though I had published papers. I had done things that people who get PhDs have also done, peer-reviewed papers and all that. So I started to look into, you know, programs that maybe I could get a PhD in Sweden or somewhere as an adult. And the context for this was that Althing, with his Nobel Prize, had been also trying since the 70s to get funding from the United States, where he lived half a year each year, for this anti-Big Bang cosmology. And he was never able to get the funding.
Wow.
So at one point, Tony laughed and he said to me, "Look, Eric, I think you should forget about the PhD. Hannes Althing has been trouble getting funding for cosmology, and he's got a Nobel Prize. That's a lot better than a PhD, so just forget it." So in the end, that advice proved right.
Yeah.
I never could get funding for the cosmology, but the lack of the PhD did not prevent me from getting some funding from NASA for the fusion. So there are ways around it, but it still acts as the badge of the priesthood.
Yes. Yes, we're going to conclude here, if that's all right. That does it for part one of this week's episode, and we look forward to having part two with Eric Lerner when we schedule that. What's Left is a weekly political podcast slash channel challenging the mainstream left. We post information about our topics and our guests on the episode notes wherever you found this episode or on our blog at what-s-left.webnode.com. You can find past episodes to this podcast slash channel there and connect with us. I remind folks, if you like anything that you have heard here, please share your favorite episode, rate, review, and subscribe to any of our six platforms on iTunes Podcast, Stitcher, Google Play, BitChute, or YouTube, and Spotify. If you would like to give us feedback about something you've heard or suggest something for us to cover, contact us through our blog. I'm Eduardo Larca with co-hosts Andy Lipson and Kenny Cepeda. Thank you again, Eric Lerner, for being with us, and we appreciate everything you've spoken with us, and we look forward to part two. That's it, and we'll see you all next time.